You're listening to the RBN Energy Blogcast. This is an audio version of RBN's Daily Energy Blog, which is a fun and insightful daily commentary on oil, gas, NGL, and refined product markets. Each morning, we cover commodity fundamentals and industry changes to keep you informed of developing trends across the U.S. energy landscape.
Wednesday, February 18, 2026. Round and round, from basic repairs to long-term investment, many steps needed to revitalize Venezuela's oil industry. Published by Lisa Scheidler. The turmoil in Venezuela has been the focus of international headlines since the start of the year, when U.S. forces removed President Nicolas Maduro from power. One of the biggest questions centers on the fate of the country's now moribund oil sector, which has suffered from decades of neglect. It's widely understood that a recovery will take a decade or more and require tens or even hundreds of billions of dollars for crude oil production to return to its heyday in the 1990s. But there are some concrete steps that could boost production in the short, medium, and long term. In today's RBN blog, we'll discuss those steps and preview our newest drill down report on the situation in Venezuela. As we've discussed in previous blogs, the unfolding situation is fluid, chaotic, and will take years to resolve. Venezuela, once a cornerstone supplier of heavy sour crude to U.S. Gulf Coast refineries, has seen its oil industry unravel after decades of decline. Production plunged from about 3.5 million barrels per day in the late 1990s to less than 1 million barrels per day today. After years of state control under Maduro and his predecessor, Hugo Chavez, chronic underinvestment has gutted production capacity and the capabilities of the country's refineries. January marked a massive shift in Venezuelan crude flows to the U.S. following the easing of sanctions and a series of political developments. The U.S. imported about 8.6 million barrels of Venezuelan crude, based on EIA estimates and RBN vessel tracking data. This is a sharp 80% increase from December's imports of roughly 4.9 million barrels and the highest level in a year. From Venezuela's perspective, a revival and true transformation of Venezuela's oil sector will depend on more than just export access. Political stability and basic public safety are foundational requirements and essential to the success of all the steps we are about to discuss. We know some improvements can occur in the near term, but all of them depend on safety and political stability. Ultimately, none of the operational or infrastructure improvements will occur at scale unless workers, service companies, and investors feel safe returning to the country and Venezuela has a politically stable environment. Short-term fixes. Up to 18 months. Improve Venezuelan upgraders. Because Venezuela's heavy crude is so thick, its viscosity is more like peanut butter than gasoline. It's challenging to transport and refine. To flow in pipelines, it must either be blended with a diluent, such as condensate or natural gasoline, or upgraded to a lighter synthetic crude oil, or SCO, a process that is capital-intensive and operationally complex. When blending or upgrading capacity is insufficient, production quickly backs up at the wellhead, which has long been a recurring problem in the Orinoco Belt, where most of the country's low API, high sulfur crude is produced. All four of the country's crude upgraders appear to be shut down. With no upgrading capacity to handle its heavy crude, Venezuela is limited to export volumes that can be moved as diluent blended barrels, a major constraint on operations. One of the first orders of business would be to improve these upgraders. We believe basic inspections and even small repairs could make a big difference. Critical inspections, leak and fire repairs, especially at Petro Sedeño after a November 2025 fire, and basic mechanical utility repairs should be the first order of business. These repairs could lead to small throughput increases, even at the healthiest upgraders, such as Petropier. Larger repairs and upgrades would be long-term projects. Get diluent back. The U.S. issued a new set of licenses in late January and early February that open a path for U.S. firms to work with Venezuelan oil. On January 29th, the Treasury Department issued a new license allowing established U.S. companies to load, transport, store, sell, and refine Venezuelan crude. Then, on February 3rd, it issued another license to establish the legal structure for outside investment in the rehabilitation of Venezuela's oil industry. This means that U.S. companies are now allowed to provide diluent to Venezuela's oil sector, which had previously been largely prohibited. Before Treasury issued these licenses, only Chevron could send diluent to Venezuela under U.S. sanctions. Most of the country's recent diluent supply had come from Iran, despite restrictions. Gaining access to more diluent could have an immediate impact, allowing pipelines to resume operations and exports to ramp up. Basic repairs on wells. A big chunk of Venezuela's shut-in production isn't stuck because of the rock. It's because the wells are literally broken. We're talking basic stuff that nearly any oil crew could tackle, such as corroded tubing, well bores plugged with waxy paraffin, and perforations packed with sand. For years, Venezuela's state-owned Petróleos de Venezuela S.A., or PDVSA, didn't have the parts, people, or budget to stay ahead of these projects, so many wells were taken offline and left that way. The quickest way to get these barrels back is through these small improvements. That means replacing worn-out submersible pumps and scraping and washing out paraffin and sand. These small, low-tech projects could make a big difference. Oilfield service companies. Bringing back big oilfield service companies, such as Halliburton and Baker Hughes, to handle chemical injection, pressure maintenance, and reservoir monitoring is critical to any real revival in Venezuela. On paper, it sounds simple, but in the real world, there could be several months of red tape with licenses, sanctions, waivers, negotiations, and other logistics. Halliburton withdrew its staff in 2020, but on the company's January 21 conference call, CEO Jeff Miller said Halliburton can mobilize in weeks and move fairly quickly as opportunities arise. Miller said the company would need to resolve any commercial and legal issues, including payment certainty. A firm like Halliburton is crucial because it essentially keeps wells healthy with chemical injections, pressure maintenance, and reservoir monitoring, much of which isn't happening today. Minor infrastructure repairs. This is different than what the oil field service companies do and what happens at the wellbore. This includes fixing pumps at tank farms, repairing loading arms at ports, patching small pipeline leaks, and restoring electricity at the field level. Right now, Venezuela sometimes shuts in wells simply because a storage tank valve is broken or a power substation failed. Cleaning up these nagging issues is another item that could bring shut-in barrels back online. Middle-term fixes, up to 5 years. Get upgraders up and running. Once the basic repairs are fixed, the upgraders will need some true capital expenditures that involve big bucks, as they've been under-maintained for years. This will require long-term, serious capex. Some very expensive equipment will need to be replaced or upgraded, like catalyst loads, replacement reactors, overhauled hydrogen units, and modern cooling systems. Bring back the workers. In recent years, thousands of experienced workers have left Venezuela. There was a 2002-03 strike against PDVSA that led to the firing of nearly 20,000 workers, or 40% of its total workforce, including many of its most capable engineers and skilled operators. According to the U.S. Energy Information Administration, or EIA, that purge, combined with a reported tendency to hire based on government loyalty rather than technical skill, continues to affect operations, resulting in a lack of high-level expertise. Winning back these experienced operators, engineers, and technicians won't be easy. They have to be physically safe and confident that they'll get paid and that their contracts and pensions will be honored. The system needs all kinds of experts, production engineers, upgraders and refinery operators, control room staff, maintenance crews, and field service specialists. Until the experienced staffers return, there will likely be ongoing maintenance issues. Long-term fixes, 5 to 10 years. These are not quick recovery suggestions, but rather full-scale development projects that would require massive capital, technology, and likely a full change in the political landscape to complete. Use Aruba as a bridge for diluent. One option to watch is Aruba's San Nicolas refinery and upgrader as a potential diluent hub for Venezuelan production. Under a lease, Citgo Aruba Refining planned to refurbish the facility and convert it into an upgrader designed to process Venezuelan heavy crude. That effort stalled in 2019 amid sanctions and the politics surrounding PDVSA. In 2020, control of the refinery and terminal reverted to Aruba's state-owned Refinería de Aruba. The Citgo ownership has been changing, and a judge in November gave the green light to Elliott Investment Management affiliate Amber Energy to purchase three coveted Citgo refineries in the U.S., along with a number of assets. We note that the final sale requires approval from the Office of Foreign Assets Control, which is part of the U.S. government. If and when that happens, there is a scenario in which Citgo could return to Aruba, though it won't be easy. Aruba would have to formally invite Citgo back in and negotiate a new agreement with the government. There is likely to be political pushback too. In November 2025, the governments of Aruba and the Netherlands announced a historic decision to end oil refining in Aruba, with the former San Nicolas refinery to be dismantled. If political plans change, could the plant serve as a staging point for condensate or naphtha moving to Venezuelan upgraders? Technically, this could happen, but current policies would need to dramatically change. New drilling in the Orinoco Belt. We all know the oil is there, but the challenge has always been how to get it out. As we just mentioned, this ultra-heavy crude just doesn't flow on its own. That means Venezuela will ultimately need new drilling programs with high-tech well designs, such as multilateral horizontals, extensive artificial lift, and, eventually, thermal wells, to move production beyond today's low base. That, in turn, would require a major build-out of steam, power, water handling, and diluent systems to support these projects. Pipelines and export terminals. Most of Venezuela's midstream system dates to the 1970s through 1990s. Years of delayed maintenance and underinvestment have left pipelines, tanks, and coastal terminals in poor condition. On top of that, much of the existing network was designed for a completely different set of crude flows and export destinations. Any meaningful rebound in Orinoco output would require new long-haul pipelines and gathering systems to move larger volumes of extra-heavy crude or diluted blends from production areas to coastal hubs. Domestic refinery rehabilitation. Our biannual Future of Fuels report dives into this issue in detail, but the country's big refineries, which once were a regional powerhouse that provided produced refined fuels to meet domestic demand, but also exports to many neighboring countries, have been limping along, operating at rates below 20% for the last several years. To understand the decline in Venezuelan refining, which has led to fuel shortages and the need for product imports, you must look at only three facilities: the massive 955,000 barrels per day Paraguaná refining center, Amuay and Cardón, 190,000 barrels per day Puerto La Cruz refinery, and the 146,000 barrels per day El Pulido refinery. Together, they represent nearly 99% of Venezuela's domestic refining capacity. Since 2019, the story has been a persistent degradation rather than a clean collapse and restart cycle. Prolonged underinvestment, loss of skilled labor, sanctions-related constraints on parts and catalysts, unreliable utilities, and repeated unplanned shutdowns. Puerto La Cruz was formally shut in 2019 and later returned at low rates. Getting Venezuela's refineries back to a reasonable level of utilization, say 75%, will require massive and sustained investments. Won't happen anytime soon, if ever, in our opinion. To go beyond patching a few units, you'd need a stable power grid or on-site power and fully reliable utilities, which could take years to achieve. After that, you would need to see sustained operation not only of crude distillation units, but also of critical and complex downstream units, such as delayed cokers, fluid catalytic cracking units, or FCCs, reformers, hydrotreaters and hydrogen systems, plus fresh catalysts, OEM parts and modern controls, along with disciplined turnaround execution. See turnaround. Venezuela has actually publicized an effort since 2020, where they brought in personnel from Iran, the National Iranian Oil Refining Company, to help rehabilitate the facilities, particularly the Paraguaná complex in El Pulido. But no real progress has been evident, as the refineries continue to operate only intermittently, with utilization rates continuing to be in the teens. Even these lackluster efforts will cease now that the U.S. is essentially running the oil industry in the country, and we expect the massive investment required in Venezuela will be prioritized towards the upstream sector to bring back production. In fact, it is more likely that domestic demand in the country could pick up over time as the economy improves and provide regionally and globally dominant USGC refiners additional demand for their refined product exports. Fiscal and institutional reform. The real challenges have been policy. Venezuela's oil sector won't approach its historic 3.5 million barrels per day output without a fundamental overhaul of investment and operations. Future growth depends on allowing long-term investment structures and encouraging private firms to pay multi-billion dollar sums with reasonable guarantees of returns on their investments. That means an overhaul and modernization of PDVSA is crucial. While the Venezuelan oil situation can look like something that is just going round and round, we are convinced a step-by-step approach with short-term fixes and middle-term and long-term plans can make a world of difference. For more on the new drill down report, click here. Round and Round was written by Brad Arnold, Matt Roberts, Chris Henderson, and Todd Harrell. It appears as the third song on Three Doors Down's fifth studio album, Time of My Life. The mid-tempo rocker is about the yin and yang of getting through the daily struggles of life to arrive at a better place. Personnel on the record were Brad Arnold, lead vocals, Matt Roberts, lead guitar, backing vocals, Chris Henderson, rhythm guitar, backing vocals, Todd Harrell bass, Greg Upchurch, drums, Howard Benson, keyboards, programming, and Michito Sanchez, percussion. Time of My Life was recorded between July and October 2010 at Bay 7 Studios in Valley Village, California, Capitol Studios in Hollywood, California, Sparky Dark Studio in Calabasas, California, and Rivergate Studios in Hendersonville, Tennessee. Produced by Howard Benson and mixed by Chris Lord-Alge, the album was released in July 2011. It went to number 1 on the Billboard Top Rock, Top Hard Rock and Top Alternative charts and number 3 on the Billboard 200 Albums chart. Six singles were released from the LP. Three Doors Down is an American rock band formed in Escatawpa, Mississippi, in 1996 by high school friends Brad Arnold, Matt Roberts, and Todd Harrell. They released their debut studio album, The Better Life, along with a top 10 hit single, Kryptonite, in February 2000. They have released six studio albums, a compilation album, 5 EPs, and 29 singles. They have won an American Music Award, 6 BMI Pop Awards, and 2 Billboard Music Awards. 9 members have passed through the band since its formation. The band has gone through some serious tragedies, including founding member and bassist Todd Harrell, who was sentenced to 2 years in prison in April 2013 for vehicular homicide after killing another driver while under the influence of controlled substances. Founding member and lead guitarist Matt Roberts died of a drug overdose in Milwaukee in August 2016 at 38. We at RBN are saddened to learn that Brad Arnold, founding member and lead vocalist, passed away at age 47 in February in Nashville after a long battle with cancer. Condolences to his family, friends, and loved ones. The future of the band is unknown at this time.
Thanks for listening to the RBN Daily Energy Blogcast. For more information on energy market reports, maps, and consulting engagements, please visit us at rbnenergy.com. And thanks for rocking with us.